At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. He's at the Civitas Institute, University of Texas at Austin, reflecting on the Supreme Court oral arguments for a case that very much will determine the direction of the tariffs announced by the President of the United States in April of this year. Richard, a very good evening. I go to the SCOTUS blog, which I enjoy reading a deal. It's well written and easy to follow given the intricacies of courts. The headline tells a story. Court appears dubious of Trump's tariffs. Otherwise, the word skeptical appears several times in the presentation to the justices. And if I may, I follow SCOTUS in reporting that the three justices associated with the left of center, that would be Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan, expressed doubt about the president's interpretation of a law written in 1977 by Congress that had a sense of emergency, but at the same time it meant to limit the president's ability to regulate, that is, to impose tariffs. That law is the one that the president has used in order to make reciprocal tariffs and also to impose burdensome tariffs on the basis of fearing fentanyl coming into the United States as a national security threat. Jackson, Sotomayor, and Kagan were dubious. Then we turn to those who were not dubious firmly. According to the oral arguments, which can be misleading, I'm aware of this, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Alito were not dubious and regard the argument by the Solicitor General, Mr. Sauer, John Sauer,
yes, that's right.
To be consistent with the powers of the president to deal with foreign affairs, and they see this as a foreign affairs matter. Then we come to the Chief Justice and Ms. Barrett and Mr. Kavanaugh and Mr. Gorsuch. I cannot determine one way or the other, although it seemed that the Chief Justice does not like the whole idea of interpreting something that doesn't say tariffs as a tariff. He's also reluctant to take taxing power away from the Congress and give it to the president. So that is the SCOTUS blog outline. How do you see the oral arguments? Are they determinative or could they be a head fake? Good evening to you, Richard.
Well, I don't think they're going to be a head fake. I think they're actually trying to figure out what's going on. They did ask hard questions on both sides, which is appropriate for the situation. But I think what in the end is going to happen is they're going to choke at least seven of them over the situation. And I would not start with the words importation or regulation, which is the way it's often done. I would start with the word emergency, which appears in the title of the statute. And the first point you would want to make it about emergency is that Trump had to define this thing so broadly so that he had the power to impose any tariff that he wanted on any nation throughout the state of the world. So his emergency was essentially an imbalance in trade with every other country in the world, where we turn out to basically buy more from them than they buy from us. Well, this has been going on for many, many years, and there are two observations about it which make it clear that the president is just crazy. During the period in which this has been going on, which is now over 90 years, the United States has done better than any of its trading partners. That's because, in fact, when you have a pretty open market and you can buy and sell, all these transactions turn out to be grains. But what the president does is we're being ripped off by these other nations. And what he doesn't know is ripping off means that you're taken advantage of. And all of these transactions are transactions that actually help anybody. And so the way he thinks about the situation is you have win after win after win in individual states. And then when you look at the whole picture, it's just one big loss. Nobody's going to believe that. The second thing, which is not stressed in the argument, is that reciprocal tariffs are simply an ignorant way of trying to do business. If you go back to Liberation Day in early April of this year, he said, I'm going to have my deals in place by July 1st. Well, he may have one or two in place, but he's not going to have any others in place because these deals don't make any sense for anybody. The essence of trade is asymmetry. I'm going to buy from you to sell to a third party, and that means I'm going to basically lose on one balance on trade, and I'm going to win on the other. Well, if you do reciprocal arrangements, you can't look at that third country or the fourth country or the fifth country. And so what he's looking at is something that's completely irrelevant to the prosperity of the United States and ignoring the only thing that matters, which is the level of successful transactions that take place. So now what he has to do is to say it is an emergency to stop the most successful system of trading in the history of the world. That's our peril. And anybody who thinks that worldwide prosperity brought by free trade is the same thing as a cyclone or as an atomic bomb or a disease or something of that sort simply does not have any intellectual mooring. So I think that's the most obvious point. And well, why is it relevant? Well, look at the title of the statute. It has the word emergency contained four square in the middle of it. And the emergencies at common law have always been a sudden, ferocious events for which there's usually not enough time to organize a market response. But if you're talking about a 90-year situation and there's a problem, some on one of the any 20, 30, or 40 Congresses in between could say, well, we're going to take advantage of this and correct it. But no Congress has ever sought to correct this. And as you mentioned, there is IEEPA. This was the second generation after the Trading with the Enemy Act. And what it did was narrow the scope of the president because of the fear of abuse. And to read the words about sudden and unexpected events as giving you a broad authorization to do whatever you want is just crazy. So looking at the basic statutory design itself, even if you thought that a taxation and regulation were the same thing, you would be wrong to assume that all the other conditions of the statute are satisfied. Then there's an interesting problem here. What do we mean by regulation and tax? If you look at the constitutional text, these things tend to be in separate compartments. Taxation is in the first part of Article 1, Section 8, and a couple of sections down, you talk about the regulation of commerce. They tend to use the words in opposition to one another. And that's the way I think you have to read it when you're looking at the statute. They're not the same thing. Economists may quarrel with that and saying, well, you could arrange a tax or a regulation to do pretty much the same thing. But they were not doing 20th century microeconomics. They were doing 18th century constitutionalism. And what they were worried about is the extent to which you can be mercantilist in the way in which you operate the system. And that's a very hard question. And so the theory was the Congress will have to decide the basic structure. And then there's the question about delegation. And the basic rule is the so-called intelligible principle rule in a case called Hampton by Chief Justice Happ. And that was a tariff case. And you know what the intelligible principle was? He said, the Germans are giving the following kinds of subsidies to certain kinds of goods. Calculate that number and tax them in order to remove the subsidy. That's an intelligible principle. It's a mathematical formula. His intelligible principle is save the world. And you just cannot take a case which was meticulously argued and briefed and discussed by a very, very great justice and treat it as an authorization to do whatever you want. So I think, in effect, when you start looking at all this history, the justices, at least seven of them, are going to do it. I think there's a real blind spot upon Justice Thomas in having this abject kind of surrender to executive power. And I'm kind of disappointed that Alito seems to be running in the opposite direction. But the three left-wing justices, they don't like Trump for a whole variety of reasons. And this is a situation in which, ironically, they can now get after Trump and get the defense of everybody who cares about free trade.
I want to make a case for the president's solicitor general. I read from SCOTUS blog. Sauer countered that the president's authority under EPA came from what he described as two layers. The first we've mentioned, the president's broad constitutional power over foreign policy and foreign relations, conceded. And the solicitor general adds, and layered on top of that is a sweeping delegation of authority from Congress. These two layers combined, said Mr. Sauer, reflected a recognition that the president has, quote, inherent powers to address international emergencies. And EPA gives the president the tools to do so. And he's keen on the terms in the law itself of imposing regulations on imports.
Well, I think he's wrong on both. On the first thing, the president does not have complete power. There was a 1936 case called Curtis Wright, where Justice Sutherland made words to that effect, but nobody has followed them since. The most recent case on this actually was very complicated. It had to do with Zivotofsky and who gets the power, Congress or the president, to figure out whether or not you put Israel on the passports. And they decided in favor of the president, but they cut back on the earlier cases. And if you look at the fact that Congress has the power to declare war, to organize the raising of an army, the president on his own authority can't even call up the militia and so forth, it's just an overall statement to do this. And then whenever you use the word inherent, it's always a dodge, because what you're saying is the power is there regardless of what the particular texts say. And then when he goes to the text, he said it was a very broad delegation. But it isn't that broad. The emergency clause sticks like a craw in his throat, and he always ignores it when he starts to make his particular argument. So I think what happens is, and the best way to read this statute is to start with the title. And it turns out he just doesn't give any situation of that. And there's another thing, I think, which is going to hurt the president if they at least think about it, which is he uses this thing as a play tool for all sorts of other stuff. Is it an emergency that the prime minister of Ontario says to the president, you're not Ronald Reagan when it comes to tariff? And then he responds with a 10% increase in tariff. Is this anything that's within his power? And he basically did it. He did the same thing in Brazil. So he doesn't even believe in the kinds of limits. He treats this as a way in which he can basically effectuate his own efforts to interfere in the internal politics of other countries. That can't be something which is IEPA supposed to do. So those cases themselves indicate that there's got to be a political motivation test there, and Trump has followed. So why do I think he's going to lose? Not happily, though, completely. Because normally the argument is he's got a lot of discretion. Everybody seems to recognize that. The problem is he has a history of abusing discretion in this particular area, as with the two cases I just mentioned. And when you have a record of abuse, of a willingness to defer is not there. And I might also add, it's a deference. It's not an absolute abnegation. And if you can prove that what he has done is not consistent with the text of the statute, then the delegation is going to fail. And the Sauer argument simply doesn't come to grips with all the other terms that are contained in the EPA situation. So he's cherry-picking the words that he thinks cut in his favor, and they're at best ambiguous, and he ignores everything else that's flatly against him, including the utter stupidity of the reciprocal tariff problem for dealing with a non-existent problem of budgetary imbalances. He has to explain to me why that's an emergency, when in fact it's utterly irrelevant, according to virtually every serious person who's ever studied international
trade. One detail, Professor, is a tariff a tax?
Of course it is.
That's clear. There's no argument there against
it. Well, if you go to the text, it says powers have about a level of taxes, and they talk about excises and imposts and duties. And so what happens is they're covering it both ways. A tax ordinarily refers to a general income tax or a wealth tax, something like that. And then there were transfer taxes on the sale of various kinds of goods. And what they did is they put all four words in there, so saying that Congress has the power to work under both authorities. So everybody believes they have it. And then the question is, having exhaustively discussed the area and having very precise and limited delegations to the president under all sorts of other statutes, what makes you think that they gave him the power to do whatever he wants here when you have those other provisions?
If the tariffs are a tax, therefore the president does not have the authority to change the tax code. That's Congress, correct?
Yeah. And what happens is you can't read this statute in isolation from all the others. And that's what he's trying to do.
And so the vote, and whenever it comes before Christmas, after Christmas, you believe will be how so, Professor?
7-2. And I think there'll be a split, just as there was in the lower court, which is some people will say is just categorically wrong. And the more moderate position says, well, occasionally you could use a tax, but this goes so far beyond accepted practices. Nobody's ever done anything remotely like this in Iran or anywhere else. And so the president is just on the wrong side of this fuzzy line between a legal authority and abuse of legal
Professor authority. Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute, who lives in New York City, and he has a new mayor elect when we come back. Zoran Mamdani.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.